Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 258, Rorke's Drift Part 2, Dabulumanzi's Gamble and Jard's Night of Horrors. It's important to listen to episode 257 if you haven't, because that sets up everything for this episode. There's too much to repeat, particularly in the layout of the buildings, which were fully described last episode. There were about 330 British and Natal native contingent troops marooned at Rorke's Drift, about to be attacked by 4,000 Zulu warriors. Approaching rapidly, the reserve Amabutho of the Zulu army, led by Prince Dabulumanzi, a man who was driven by pride and personal valour, loyal to his king, brave, yet impulsive compared to Cetshwayo Khambandi's politics of restraint. Dabulumanzi's name means the one who conquers waters, most apt because he had decided to lead the warriors across the Imzinyati River into Natal, a literal crossing and a metaphorical defiance. Zulu oral tradition refers to this battle as Shiani, or Kwajimu, Jim's Land, after Jim Rorke, who built the training store. It was 4 p.m., January 22nd, 1879. The barricades were still going up at the drift, the sacks of mealies, the boxes of bully beef and biscuits, when Lieutenant Henderson and Hlubi Molefe of the Batokwa native contingent rode up with 80 of their mounted men. Lieutenant John Chard of the Royal Engineers, who commanded Rorke's Drift, realized they'd managed to make their own way across the Mzinyati pontoon, and he asked the horsemen to recce up the river beyond Shiani Mountain. If you remember, that was the high point immediately behind Rorke's Drift's two buildings, the house slash hospital and the trading store slash church slash commissariat. Henderson offered to help defend the supply depot, a hollow offer, as you'll hear shortly. Chard had been operating blindly since his observers had scurried back down the Shiani after they realized three groups of Zulu regiments were approaching. Henderson took his mounted unit around the southern flank of the Shiani, where they could observe the territory from higher ground. A short while later, scattered shots were heard, and Henderson and his unit galloped back, and he shouted, "Here they come, as black as hell and as thick as grass." Henderson and another rider, Bob Hall, lingered for some moments beyond the orchard in front of Rorke's Drift. They fired a few shots to the north. Then, instead of coming to help, they turned and galloped away. They had survived St. Luana, after all, and could not stomach further action. Chard was going to bump into these two later during the Anglo-Zulu War, and they would apologize for fleeing and leaving the small group of defenders to fend for themselves. Watching from within the walls of boxes and bags were the Natal native contingent and their commanders. The men flung down the sacks they were using to construct the walls and bolted through the barricades, following Henderson. Their white officers ran away as well, along with most of the NCOs, including Corporal Anderson. He was a Scandinavian who spoke very little English, and the sight of the men of the NNC he commanded running away, along with their supposed officers, panicked him, and he ran off too. Soldiers of Bravo Company left behind were enraged. Several opened fire on the cowards fleeing the scene. Corporal Anderson was shot through the back of the head, killed instantly. Now, the irony of South African history right there. The first man on the British side to die at Rorke's Drift was shot by his own side. 200 of Chard's 300 defenders had fled, leaving him with 140 officers, NCOs and troops. 35 of those were sick. Chard had posted a guard near the casks of rum in the storehouse with orders for anyone who tried to get their hands on the drink to be shot on sight. A drunken redcoat in this situation was going to be more trouble than they were worth. He had also had a flash of inspiration and built a much smaller central redoubt inside the barricade they'd thrown up, a kind of last stand temple. A wall of wooden biscuit boxes now lay across the middle of the compound behind the main wall. It was only two boxes high, but was going to be crucial in the coming hours. But they had been forced to leave most of the wounded in the house slash hospital. Only 8 of those had the energy to make their way to behind the mealie sack wall. After Henderson's men had fled, at about 4:30 in the afternoon, the Luyengwe regiment marched into sight around the southern side of Shiani Mountain. Only a handful at first, 20 or so, they were the vanguard, and formed themselves up into a long skirmishing line, just as the British would have done. Soon at least 600 more warriors joined them, and formed up in a classic crescent shape that extended from Shiani towards Kwa Singindi to the southeast. A few kilometres away to the west on the main road to Halt Mekaar, Rorke's drift owner Otto Witt looked back from the vantage point of his horse, and he saw the first Zulus running towards the barricades. The battle of Rorke's drift had begun. As the warriors approached, they began a heavy, if inaccurate, fire, and they wheeled about to their right, advancing quickly to the south wall Chard had thrown up. On the British side, James Dalton was regarded as one of the most accurate shots at Rorke's drift, and he took aim at a mounted Induna, who appeared to be leading the Luyengwe, and shot him off his horse. Still, the warriors approached rapidly, trotting in fire and movement style, close to the ground, taking advantage of the cover afforded by the antels, the bushes, the trees, the tall grass, the dongas, and the small stream banks. When they reached a point about half a kilometre from the British position, Bravo Company opened fire, and many warriors fell wounded or killed. But the Luyengwe came on, undeterred, and made it to within 50 metres of the southern wall, but then they were bunched up, and an easy target for the accurate British riflemen. They had been caught in a vicious crossfire between the wall and the hospital and the store, and they turned to their left. This was to be the only full Zulu-style charge of the battle. On the south side, they took cover behind the ovens there, and the numerous banks and the ditches. Still the Luyengwe came on, streaming behind the hospital now, trying to rush the building and the line of millie bags. They found there was more cover here than at the front of Rorke's drift. There was no crossfire, and the area was covered with trees and bushes and grass. This larger group managed to force their way all the way to the northwest wall, where they were opposed by men like James Dunbar and Sergeant Bromhead, the pocket rocket I mentioned last episode. A fierce hand-to-hand fight developed here, and something mysterious began to take place. Where the Zulus had continued attacking in the face of the terrible firepower of the Martini Henry bullets, it was the flashing blades of the bayonets that they appeared to fear. Private Hitch said later, "Had the Zulus taken the bayonet as freely as they took the bullets, we could not have stood more than 15 minutes. The Zulus had a dread of the bayonet that was going to have implications as this battle developed, a reluctance to face cold steel, an inexplicable development because Zulu warriors had been trained from childhood to use the spear, or the ikwa, their stabbing spear, which was a sword in many ways, and yet they dreaded the infantryman's bayonet, and maybe for good reason. This weapon was 47 centimetres long, slim, extremely sharp, glinting steel, nicknamed the lunger by the infantry because it increased a soldier's reach to 2 metres, but double the reach of a Zulu stabbing spear. Unlike traditional African spears, the bayonet could not easily be turned aside by a shield because of its sharp point, which punched through the hardened hide. Then a soldier would simply pull the shield away. The Inyangas had ritually protected the warriors from bullets, not bayonets. By now, other regiments arrived. The rest of the Utulwana, the Ndlondlo, and the Dloko. These hurried forward. Some of the older men climbed up the Shiani and took positions on the ledges and behind rocks and began peppering the British position below from 400 metres away. Reinforced, the Luyengwe advanced right up to the hospital and along the wall of the mealie bags, but the attackers were repulsed by the British. Intense hand-to-hand fighting continued. Bodies began to accumulate along the approaches to the buildings. The Tulwana bore the brunt of these casualties. The Zulu snipers on the Shiani began to hit the British, who were exposed, their heads and backs clearly visible. In more than an hour and a half of fighting, this battle had not begun to play out, but the sun was setting. This was going to be the first and only night battle of the Anglo-Zulu War. In the last rays of the setting sun, it had become clear to the Zulu that the weakest point of British defences lay along the front of the hospital. They began to focus their surges on this point, unrelenting in their assaults. Between the buildings, the 3-metre-high rocky ledge and mealie bag redoubt proved impossible for the warriors to climb. The Zulu kept to the bush here, firing their old trade guns non-stop, and after an hour and a half of this assault, the entire area appeared to be bathed in a ghostly white smoke. The combatants wreathed in poisonous clouds. "Heavens," remarked Surgeon Reynolds later, "they rain lead at us at the distance of a cricket pitch or two. We stood up face to face, white men and black, and blazed at each other until nightfall." By now, the hospital veranda was impossible to defend, and a few sacks and boxes were dragged into place connecting the right front of the hospital with the front barricade. Chard ordered the defenders back to the spot, abandoning the slope up to the building. This meant they now had an excellent view of Zulus running towards the veranda. Some of the warriors charged and leapt over the parapet, only to be shot down. Frank Bourne was impressed. "Looking back, one cannot but admire their fanatical bravery." The numerical superiority of the Indlu-Yengwe began to take its toll. On the Shiani, in this rapidly darkening night, and nestled among the sandstone rocks, Zulu snipers continued their constant fire down on the backs of the British. Because they were so close, had they been armed with the more modern Martini Henry rifles, this would have been like shooting fish in a barrel. But the Zulus on the terrace were firing much older weapons, muzzle loaders, scarcely accurate when the range was beyond 50 meters, and they were 30 years old, meaning the worn barrels reduced the power of the shot, further worsening their accuracy. But Zulu Prince Tabulumanzi's entourage had been taught to fire by John Dunn, and they began to find their mark. Several British soldiers were hit in quick succession, musket balls striking their exposed torsos. Surgeon Reynolds had set up a casualty post on the storehouse veranda, which was relatively protected from direct fire. He patched up the increasing number of wounded, while his Jack Russell, called Dick, yapped and generally made a nuisance of itself. While the snipers had a clear view, it was the concentrated Zulu fire coming from the front of the post that also began to pick off the British. Private Thomas Cole, who was claustrophobic inside the hospital, found the cacophony of battle too much. The screaming of the wounded, the booming of the guns, soldiers shouting insults. Unbearable in the confined space of the hospital, he ran out onto its veranda as the fighting reached its peak. He was shot clean through the head, the ball passing through him, then breaking the nose of Private Bush, who fought nearby. Corporal Scammell was shot through the shoulder. He collapsed, was dragged to the surgeon who patched him up. Scammell crawled back out into the yard as James Dalton rushed back and forth, when he suddenly stiffened. Dalton had been hit above the right shoulder blade. He turned calmly and handed his rifle to Lieutenant Chard so coolly that the lieutenant said later, "I had no idea of how severely he was wounded." Scammell clambered to his feet, staggered over to seek help. A local civilian storekeeper called Louis Byrne, who was hired as part of the commissariat, handed Scammell his water bottle and was promptly shot through the head and killed. This sudden increase in casualties was turning into a problem for Chard. The post, peppered by Zulu rounds from all sides, although the warriors had decided to stop trying to charge the rear wall. At the front, a different story. The Zulus had reached the doors of the hospital, and they were trying to break them down, while grabbing the defenders' bayonets as they stuck these out of the loopholes. Darkness took hold. Chard was forced to order his men back to the internal redoubt, the last stand. This concentrated British fire, making it even more destructive, but it gave the Zulu free rein over the western approach to the post. The hospital was isolated. The men inside now left to their fate. The warriors burst through the outer doors and began to drive the defenders room to room. This battle was becoming more and more personal. The defenders and attackers in close proximity, every sound accentuated, the blasts of the guns leaving everyone dazed, the ears ringing, the sparks creating an apocalyptic vision where their senses were battered beyond reason. Figures loomed out of the darkness, as Private Hook of Gloucestershire explained later. He was one of the six members of Bravo Company tasked with protecting the men abandoned in the hospital. Hook could hear the bullets thwacking into the biscuit boxes, thudding into the mealie bags. Then he heard the terrifying ripping and whizzing sound of the tip of the assegais as they were flashed. his claustrophobic friend Thomas Cole dead, Hook was left protecting a black NNC auxiliary, one of Prince Mkungu Isikhosa's men. Wounded in the leg, he was too heavily bandaged to move. He called out, "Take my bandage off so that I can come," but it was too late. He was speared as Hook leapt to safety. A thick, dense smoke began to drift through the building. The Zulus had set fire to the hospital thatch. Damp from rain, it had smouldered before catching a light. And now the soldiers in the hospital had no choice but to try and make a run for it. It was either be massacred or burned alive or get out of the building. After breaking down a door, Hook was now in a room with half a dozen of the wounded, joined by Private John Williams. They couldn't break down the other internal doors, which had been bricked up, as you've heard. It was impossible to know which room was controlled by the British or the Zulu. Guessing, Williams grabbed one of the pickaxes, hacking at the sun-dried, mud-brick-plastered partition walls, which gave way as the Zulus hammered at their closed door. Williams and Cole began dragging the patients to the eastern rooms, then out into the yard, trying desperately to escape the flames. Private Waters was alive and alongside, and in a moment of brilliance, grabbed Otto Witt's black priestly cloak and threw it over himself. He disappeared into the darkness. An invisibility cloak at a time of extreme need. Some of the British survivors managed to steal away into the bush unseen. Others lay between the bodies of the dead and dead horses. One lay behind a stray pig that had rushed out of the darkness during the battle and was shot. Thus fate was playing out that night. Hook, Williams, and two men called Jones, along with a few patients, tried to escape across the yard to the redoubt. Prince Tabulamanzi had been commanding the battle from the slopes of Shiani, but came under heavy fire and moved. By now it was impossible for the Zulu commanders to issue orders. They did not usually fight at night. Command and control was out of the window. Evil powers usually emerged at night, the Mnyama, but still the men fought on, hoping for victory, for some kind of proof that they had ignored Cetshwayo's orders for a good reason. He did not want his army west of the Imzinyati inside Natal territory, so now they just had to overcome Rorke's Drift. The Redcoats held on to only a tiny piece of land in the middle of this post. Surely they had no hope. It was the decision to set fire to the hospital that ultimately doomed this attack, because instead of having the option of launching surprise surges in the dark, the whole area was now lit up by the blazing thatch roof like a high-powered flare. Harry Lugg put it this way. "The thatch roof burst out into flames and made it light as day, and before they had time to retreat, we were pouring bullets into them like hail." While that may have been a post-battle boast, it was true. Lieutenant Bromhead and seven men were holding the weakest corner of this redoubt, at the junction of the front mealy bag wall and the biscuit boxes. Several of Bromhead's section were hit one after the other. Private Edward Nicholas through the head, killed instantly. Private Hitch shot through the right shoulder, his arm flapping about uselessly, so he tucked it into his belt and used his left. But he needed two hands to load, so he grabbed an armful of ammunition packets and distributed these, finally collapsing, losing blood. His friend Private Deacon offered to put him out when it came to the finish, shoot him, but Hitch said, "No, thanks." The warriors changed direction, moving to the eastern end of the post, as far away from the burning hospital as they could, taking advantage of the darkness here, and began a series of assaults through the calf pen, but they were driven back. Walter Dunn, the son of John Dunn, was co-opted to build a final redoubt, a kind of hollow pyramid of mealy bags. He was tall and an easy target. Zulu bullets whizzed about him. The throwing spears clattered about him. But instead of talking of these close calls later, he said merely, "Overhead, the small birds, disturbed from their nests by the turmoil and smoke, flew hither and thither confusedly." The swallows of Rorke's Drift lent a somewhat melancholic moment to this terrible time. The fighting died down at 10 p.m. Zulu attacks were less determined. They had run out of steam. Some continued to shout "Usutu" from different directions, but at midnight, the shooting slackened considerably. The British faces lit up as the hospital rafters began collapsing, the fire flaring for seconds. In the early morning, The British and Zulu, lying in their respective positions, took to exchanging salutations instead of bullets. For both sets of fighters, they had bludgeoned themselves into a stupor. The Zulu had begun the day 18 kilometers away in Ingwebeni. They'd run to Rorke's Drift. They'd crossed the flooding river. They'd fought for hours, hand to hand, fed only on a handful of roast mealies on the morning of the 22nd. The adrenaline of battle had worn off, and now most began to slip away, because, of course, there was still the 100-kilometer long walk home to consider. And so ended one of the seminal battles of South African history, bathed in the blood and flames of the Victorian era, to develop a mythology of gargantuan proportions in both British and Zulu narrative traditions. These two battles, Isandlwana and Rorke's Drift, cemented the colonial and African traditions into a curious symbiosis. One, a magnificent if costly battle and victory for the Zulu. The other, a grand tale of gallantry under fire, a propaganda coup in the midst of a catastrophe. Because whatever spin the British wanted to place on these two events, both had completely upended the empire's political order. In the next episode, I'll explain what deafening resonance this one day, the 22nd of January 1879, had on South African, British, and importantly, global history. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. Head off to desmondlatham.blog. Updates of various episodes are loaded. You can email me from there. You can also sign up for my little newsletter. Until next, goodbye.